The Bowery tenement on Grand Street smelled of boiled cabbage and something underneath it that Pearl couldn't name and didn't want to. She stood at the threshold of the building with her collar turned up against the November wind, watching a woman in a faded blue dress sweep the same patch of floor for the third time. The broom moved in tight, anxious arcs. The woman's eyes kept darting toward the stairs. Pearl counted three flights before she found the right door. Number 4. A child's drawing taped to the peeling paint three stick figures beneath a yellow sun that took up half the paper. She knocked twice, waited, knocked again. The chain rattled. The door opened an inch, then wider. The woman standing there was small and sharp-edged, dark hair pulled back so tightly it pulled at the corners of her eyes. Two children sat on the floor behind her, a boy and a girl, both maybe 5, both watching Pearl with the wary stillness of animals that had learned noise brought trouble. "I'm looking for Alina Rossi," Pearl said. The woman's mouth flattened. "Who wants to know?" "Detective Pearl Casey, independent." The title felt thin on her tongue, like wrapping paper over nothing. "I need to ask about Thomas Erickson." Something shifted behind Alina's face, a flicker of fear, then anger, then something that might have been relief. She unlatched the door fully and stepped aside. "Come in, quickly, the hallway has ears." The room was one space divided by a threadbare curtain. On one side, a table with three chairs and a pot of cold tea. On the other, two children's cots pushed together and a wash basin on a crate. The smell of cabbage was stronger here, woven through with the sour tang of damp plaster. Alina gestured to a chair and took the table itself, sitting forward with her elbows on her knees, her hands clasped so hard her knuckles showed white. "Thomas was my husband's cousin," she said, the words coming fast, Italian cadence sharpening the edges of her English. "He stayed here sometimes when the factory shifts ran late. You already know that. Why are you here?" Pearl kept her voice level. "He died last night, found near the East River." Alina's hands unclenched, they trembled. She pressed them flat against the table to steady them. "Drowned." "That's what the sergeant says." "The sergeant says what he's told to say." Alina's voice dropped, rapid and anxious. "You think Thomas drowns? He swam in the lake at home every summer before he came to America. He could hold his breath longer than my Marco, and the boy is 7. She glanced at the curtain, where the children had gone very still. "He didn't drown." Pearl leaned forward. "What do you think happened?" Alina hesitated. Her eyes went to the window, a narrow rectangle of gray light. When she spoke again, her voice was lower, measured. "3 nights ago, he came here late, not for his usual stay. He was upset, angry. He sat right where you're sitting and he talked about the factory. About the foreman, about money. Sergeant Doyle took the key from him then, locked it away in the station evidence chest, but he said I might need it later." "What about money?" The memory surfaced unbidden, sharp as a blade. Back at the temporary morgue on Draper Street, while Harlan and the uniformed officers argued over cause of death, Pearl had pried open the stiff seam of Thomas Erickson's right trouser leg. The hand stitches had been tight, nearly invisible against the coarse wool. Her fingers had brushed metal, not a button, but a small key wrapped in oilcloth, tucked deep into the hem. She'd slipped it into her pocket before anyone noticed, the way you'd pocket a coin from a beggar's cup. Pearl felt the key in her pocket, a cold weight against her thigh. Did he mention anyone by name? Anyone who might have had reason to be angry with him? Alina's head shook. No names, but he said the men in gray coats were watching the tenements. He didn't say who they were or what they wanted. He just said they were watching. She met Pearl's eyes, and there was something raw in the look, fear sharpened into urgency. You need to leave, now. If they see you asking questions, they'll come back, and next time they won't just watch. What men in gray coats? I don't know, Alina's voice cracked. Please, Thomas is dead. I heard it from the neighbor upstairs. I need to believe it was an accident, because if it wasn't, and if they're still watching, she stopped. Her mouth pressed into a thin line. Go. Pearl stood. The chair scraped against the floor, and both children flinched. She kept her movements slow, deliberate. Alina, if you remember anything else, anything at all, you come to me. I'm at the police station on Broome. Ask for Detective Casey. Alina didn't answer. She was already moving toward the curtain, her hand finding the boy's shoulder, guiding him away from the door, away from Pearl. The conversation was over. Outside, the wind had picked up. Pearl walked 3 blocks before she let herself stop, turning down an alley where a barrel smoldered and the smell of coal smoke mixed with the river's rot. She reached into her pocket and felt the key again. Cold brass, teeth cut fine, almost delicate. She hadn't been able to turn it in any lock at the factory. None of them fit. A horse clattered past on the street, its driver shouting something Pearl didn't catch. She stepped back against the brick wall and watched the alley mouth. Two figures stood across the street, just visible through the drifting fog. Gray coats, standing still, not talking to each other, just watching the tenement entrance. Pearl pressed herself deeper into the shadow of the alley and held her breath. One of the figures shifted his weight. The other raised a hand to his face, smoking a cigarette, probably. She couldn't be sure. The distance was too great, the fog too thick. She waited until her legs ached and the cold seeped through her boots. Then she turned and walked the other way, keeping to the alleys, counting doors, making sure no one followed. The key burned against her skin. The men in gray coats hadn't moved when she left. They were still there when she glanced back 2 blocks later. She was no longer investigating a death. She was being watched while she investigated it, and that changed everything. The Broome Street Station house smelled of wet wool, stale tobacco, and the peculiar metallic tang of too many men sleeping in the same room. Pearl pushed through the double doors at 9 o'clock, shaking rain from her coat, and found Sergeant Doyle behind his desk with a cup of coffee that had long since gone cold. He looked up as she entered, his gray eyes narrowing beneath bushy brows that seemed permanently furrowed, as though he'd spent the last 20 years squinting at bad news. At 45, Doyle carried the weight of the precinct in his shoulder slumped forward, heavy, resigned. "You're early," he said. His voice had that gravelly quality, like stones grinding together underwater. "I'm precise," Pearl replied, dropping her umbrella against the leg of his desk. "There's a difference." Doyle took a slow sip from his mug, grimaced at the temperature, and set it down. "What do you want, Casey?" "The Erickson case. I need access to the autopsy report. Full details, not the one-line summary you filed with the coroner." Doyle sighed. It was a long, tired sound that seemed to come from somewhere deep in his chest. He leaned back in his chair, the wood creaking under his weight, and steepled his fingers. "Harlan already signed off. Drowning, accidental." "That's what you told the paper." "That's what the facts support." "The facts don't include the stitching on his trousers." Pearl reached into her coat and pulled out the key, the brass one she'd carefully extracted from Thomas Erickson's hem. She placed it on Doyle's desk between his coffee mug and a stack of unpaid reports. It landed with a small, definitive click. Doyle stared at it. He didn't touch it. "What's this?" "It's a key, sewn into the dead man's pants by someone who knew exactly what they were doing. That's not the work of a drunk who fell off a pier, Sergeant. That's intent." Doyle picked up the key anyway, holding it up to the dim light filtering through the grimy window above his desk and turning it over in his thick fingers. It was an ordinary key brass, worn at the bow, teeth cut in a standard pattern. Nothing special about it. That was almost worse. "Where did you get this?" "From the dead man, your dead man." He set the key back down. Harlan said the trousers were soaked through, saltwater damage. He didn't mention any key. "Because you didn't ask him to look." Pearl kept her voice level. She'd learned that trick from her father. Never raise your pitch when the other person was already annoyed. It only made them angrier. "I examined the body myself before it was zipped up. There were hand stitches on the right leg hem. 6 of them. Tight. Someone sewed that key inside the fabric before or maybe after he died. Either way, it wasn't an accident." Doyle rubbed his temples. When he spoke again, his Irish lilt had deepened, the vowels stretching wider. "Pearl, listen to me. A machinist goes out drinking on a Tuesday, stumbles into the East River and drowns. We get 40 of those a month. Sometimes 40 in a week during the winter. The water's cold, the docks are slippery, and men who work 12 hours a day on milling machines tend to lose their balance when they've had 3 whiskeys. That's not what happened here." "Then prove it." Doyle's voice hardened. "You're an independent contractor. You don't have jurisdiction. You don't have authority. And you certainly don't have the resources to go digging into a closed case because you found a piece of metal in Thomas Erickson's pocket." "It wasn't in his pocket. It was sewn into his hem." Doyle picked up the key again and dropped it into an empty inkwell on his desk. It sank out of sight with a small splash. Case closed. Go home, Casey. Pearl stared at the inkwell. The key was gone submerged in dark liquid, invisible. She felt something tighten in her chest, a familiar frustration that tasted like copper. Her father used to say the same thing, "You're looking for ghosts where there are only drunks." He'd been a good detective once. Now he was just a ghost himself, buried 6 feet under in Greenwood Cemetery, and Doyle was carrying on his legacy with practiced ease. "You're dismissing it," she said. "I'm prioritizing. There are active burglaries on the Lower East Side. A man was stabbed on Mott Street last night. Those are cases with victims who are still breathing. Erickson is dead. Harlan says he drowned. The river takes people, Pearl. It doesn't care who they are." "But someone put that key in his pants." "Maybe he stole it. Maybe he picked it up off the dock and put it in his pocket, and it worked its way into the hem when the water got inside his trousers. Maybe it's nothing." Doyle stood up. He was taller than she remembered, 6 feet maybe, with a frame that had filled out over years of bad meals and late nights. "I'm telling you officially, drop it. You're poking around places you don't belong, and I won't have you dragging the precinct into a mess over a dead drunk's pocket lint." Pearl didn't move. She kept her hands clasped in front of her, nails pressing into her palms hard enough to leave marks. Outside the window, a streetcar clattered past on broom, the bells ringing sharp and urgent. Somewhere down the hall, a pneumatic tube hissed once, twice, and then went silent. "If it's nothing," she said quietly, "then why did 3 men in gray coats follow me to the Bowery yesterday? Why were they standing outside Alina Rossi's building when I went to interview her? Why does everyone seem to know I'm asking questions about Thomas Erickson?" Doyle's expression didn't change, but something shifted in his eyes, a flicker of something that might have been guilt or fear or both. "That's not my concern."
"It should be."
"No," he turned away, picking up a file from his desk and pretending to read it. The gesture was so obviously performative that Pearl almost laughed. "Almost. That's why I'm telling you to walk away, before it becomes my concern." She reached into her coat pocket and felt the weight of her notebook against her ribs. Inside were her observations, the stitching, the key, the men in gray coats, the way Thomas Erickson's face had been bruised in a pattern that suggested he'd been struck before he hit the water. All of it dismissed with a shrug and a cup of cold coffee. She picked up the key from the inkwell. It came out slick with black ink, dripping onto Doyle's desk. He didn't stop her. "Good morning, Sergeant," she said and walked out. The corridor was narrow and dim, lined with corkboards covered in wanted posters and missing persons notices. A desk sergeant sat by the entrance, smoking a cigarette and reading a newspaper folded to the sports section. He didn't look up when Pearl passed. Outside, the rain had stopped, but the sky remained the color of wet slate. Pearl pulled her collar up and started walking west, her boots splashing through puddles that reflected the gas lamps still burning along the street. The key was in her pocket now, wet and heavy, and she couldn't feel it through the fabric of her coat. She needed to figure out what the key opened. The factory locks had been checked. She'd verified that herself. None of them fit. But Erickson had worked at the mill for 6 years. He wouldn't carry a key he didn't need, unless it wasn't a factory key at all. Pearl turned onto Canal Street and headed toward the machine shops near the waterfront. If the key wasn't for the factory, it was for something else. Something connected to Erickson. Something someone had gone to considerable lengths to hide. A streetcar passed in the opposite direction, its passengers pressed against the windows like sardines in a tin. Pearl watched it go, thinking about the men in gray coats. They hadn't approached her. They hadn't spoken. They just watched. Watching was worse than threatening, threats you could prepare for. Watching required patience, and patience implied resources. Resources meant money. Money meant connections. Connections meant someone in the precinct was feeding information. Doyle's warning echoed in her head. "You're poking around places you don't belong." She didn't belong in the police station, that was true. She wasn't sworn in. She didn't have a badge or a gun or the authority to compel testimony. But she had something Doyle didn't. She had nothing to lose. Her father was dead. Her reputation was already stained by whatever whispers circulated among the other investigators. If she disappeared, no one would file a report. No one would care. The thought should have frightened her. Instead, it felt like freedom. Pearl quickened her pace. The machine shops were 3 blocks east, past the warehouses and the tanneries and the row of boarded-up shops where businesses had gone under during the last panic. She'd been there once before, during her initial investigation, but she'd only looked at the exterior. The locks on the main doors had been changed since Erickson's death, she could tell by the fresh scratches on the iron frames. Someone was nervous, or someone was hiding something. She turned the corner onto a side street and stopped short. Two men in gray coats stood across the road, leaning against a lamppost, talking to each other in low voices. They weren't looking at her. They were looking at the entrance to the alley beside the warehouse, the same alley Pearl had taken when she'd visited the factory the first time. They were waiting for her. Pearl turned around and walked the other way, keeping to the shadows along the building walls. Her heart was beating steadily, not fast, not panicked, just aware, alert. She dealt with being followed before. It was easier when you knew what you were running toward. The machine shop was still 3 blocks east. She could take the long way around, through the market district, but that would add 20 minutes. 20 minutes gave the men in gray coats time to position themselves between her and the shop. She needed to lose them first. Pearl ducked into an alley between a butcher shop and a printery. The smell of blood and ink mixed in the damp air, sharp and overwhelming. She moved quickly, her boots silent on the cobblestones, and emerged onto a narrower street that cut through to the main thoroughfare. She doubled back, circled a block, and then took a different route entirely, threading through a maze of alleys that connected the warehouse district to the garment quarter. It took her 12 minutes to reach the machine shop. She approached from the rear, keeping low, and peered through a broken window at the ground floor. The interior was dark, but moonlight filtered through the grime-coated skylights, illuminating dust motes that drifted like snow in the still air. Everything looked undisturbed, except for the lock on the side door. Pearl stepped closer and examined it. Fresh scratches marred the iron around the keyhole deep gouges, as though someone had tried to force the lock recently. But the door itself was intact. Whatever had happened here, it hadn't succeeded. She reached into her pocket and touched the key. It was warm from her body heat, the ink dried to a dull crust on its surface. If it opened this lock, she'd have answers. If it didn't, she'd wasted her one chance at a physical lead. Pearl inserted the key into the keyhole. It slid in smoothly, resistanceless, and turned with a satisfying click. The door swung inward on quiet hinges. Pearl stepped inside and pulled the door shut behind her. The darkness was absolute except for the faint moonlight from above. She listened. Nothing. No footsteps, no voices, no signs of life. Just the slow drip of water from a leaky pipe somewhere in the building and the distant rumble of a freight train crossing the bridge. She pulled a match from her pocket and struck it against the wall. The flame flared bright, then settled into a steady orange glow. She held it low, shielding it with her cupped hand, and began to move deeper into the shop. The interior was larger than she'd expected. Rows of milling machines stood in neat formation, their iron frames dark and silent. Workbenches lined the walls, cluttered with tools and scrap metal and half-finished parts. The air smelled of oil and iron and something else, something chemical, sharp and acrid, that made her eyes water. Pearl moved between the machines, her match burning lower with each step. She was halfway across the room when she saw it, a small office tucked into the far corner, separated from the main floor by a glass partition. The door was closed. The key was still in her pocket. She approached the office door and inserted the key. It turned. Inside, the room was small and tidy. A desk dominated the space, covered in papers and ledgers and a single brass lamp that hadn't been lit. Behind the desk, a bookshelf held files organized by date and category. Pearl's match had burned down to her fingertips, and she crushed it out before lighting another. The second flame revealed what she'd been looking for. On the desk, beneath a stack of correspondence, was a ledger bound in dark leather. The title was embossed in gold lettering, Erickson Machine Works Confidential. Pearl opened it. The pages were filled with handwriting-dense columns of figures, dates, and names. But it wasn't just production records. Beneath the numbers were annotations in a different hand, smaller, tighter, written in red ink. Payment received, July 12, Vane & Co. Shipment delayed, August 3, sabotage approved. Worker replacement requested, September 17, Erickson resistant. Pearl's breath caught, she flipped further. The entries continued, month after month, documenting payments, delays, and replacements. And then, near the end. October 28, Erickson discovered irregularities, disciplinary action required. October 28, that was the day before Thomas Erickson died. Pearl closed the ledger slowly. Her hands were shaking, not from fear, from rage. Cold, clean rage that burned brighter than any match. Someone had killed Thomas Erickson for refusing to participate in sabotage. Someone had sewn a key into his trousers to lead her here, to this ledger, to the proof that connected his death to something much larger than a drowning. And someone had been watching her every move to make sure she found it. Pearl slipped the ledger into her coat and turned to leave. As she reached the door, a sound froze her in place. Footsteps, heavy, deliberate, approaching from the main floor outside the office. Pearl killed the second match and stood in darkness, her hand on the doorknob, listening. The footsteps stopped just beyond the glass partition. A beam of light swept across the room, a lantern, held low. The light passed over the workbenches, the machines, the shelves. It paused at the office door. Pearl held her breath. The light lingered on the door for 3 seconds. 4, 5. Then it moved on, sweeping toward the rear of the shop. Footsteps continued, heading away. Pearl exhaled slowly and opened the door. The shop was empty, but the front entrance was open now. She could see moonlight spilling through it, and the smell of oil and chemicals hung thick in the air. Someone had been here recently. Recently enough that the footprints on the dusty floor were still visible. Recently enough that the lantern had been lit and carried through the rooms. Pearl stepped out into the main floor and followed the footprints to the front door. They led outside, toward the street, but there were other footprints, too smaller, lighter, circling the shop from a different direction. These ones stopped at the side door, the one she'd just opened. The person who'd left those footprints had been watching the shop before Pearl arrived. They'd seen her enter. They'd waited until she was inside before moving on. Which meant they knew she was there. Which meant they'd let her in. Pearl backed away from the door and pulled the ledger from her coat. It was heavier than she'd expected, dense with information and implication. She tucked it back inside and turned toward the rear exit. If someone was waiting at the front, the back might be clear. She moved quickly, staying low, navigating the rows of machines by memory. The rear door was locked from the outside, a simple bolt, rusted but functional. Pearl tested it. Locked. She tried the window beside it. Also locked, the glass cracked but intact. Trapped. Pearl pressed her ear against the door and listened. Silence, then, faintly, the sound of a streetcar passing on the main road. Traffic, movement, life. She was locked in a machine shop with a stolen ledger and a killer who knew her name. Pearl turned from the door and faced the darkness of the shop. The ledger burned against her ribs like a brand. She had two choices: wait for the person outside to leave and hope the front door stayed open, or find another way out. She chose the window. Pearl picked up a heavy wrench from the nearest workbench and brought it down on the cracked glass. The pane shattered outward, shards raining onto the cobblestones below. She climbed through the opening, cutting her palm on a jagged edge, and dropped to the ground on the other side. The alley was narrow and dark, smelling of garbage and wet brick. Pearl stood for a moment, catching her breath, then turned and ran. Behind her, in the machine shop, a lantern flared to life in the window. Pearl didn't look back. She ran until her lungs burned and her legs ached, threading through alleys and across side streets, the ledger pressed against her chest like a shield. The men in gray coats were still out there. She could feel them in the spaces between streetlights, in the shadows that moved when she wasn't looking. But she had the ledger now, and the ledger had names. Pearl turned the corner onto Grand Street and stopped. The Bowery tenement was two blocks ahead. Alina Rossi lived there. And if the ledger was right, if Erickson had been killed for resisting sabotage, then Alina might know more than she'd admitted. Pearl started walking again, slower now, her steps measured. She needed to think. She needed to plan. And she needed to figure out who Silas Vane was before the man in the gray coats decided that silence was cheaper than negotiation. The key was still in her pocket, wet, heavy, useless now that it had done its job. Pearl touched it once, then left it behind, letting it fall into a gutter grate as she crossed the street. Some keys were meant to be lost. Others were meant to open doors you couldn't close again. She chose the latter.